Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the first presidential debate and speak with Tom Rochhert, who served as a national security speechwriter for President Clinton and wrote a prescient article about Donald Trump, whose weakness was on display last night in Politico back in July, warning that, quote, "Nothing is more dangerous than a weak man with power, and Trump is weak, very weak. He can't take the pain of arguments and evidence that contradict his self-image." We'll discuss the wilting of Trump before the eyes of 100 million viewers as his bluster increasingly rang hollow and he resorted to campaign slogans with meandering responses that became more and more childish when challenged on his birther crusade and hyped-up record as a businessman. We'll also try to assess whether in our poisonous, polarized, and tribal political climate, minds can be changed by such an obvious exhibition of an empty suit barking at a composed and accomplished woman. Then we'll examine the impact of the 7.6 million overseas vote in this election that are vulnerable to hacking and speak with John Paul Bernbach, who was a spokesman for Democrats Abroad and the Democratic Party in Europe in the 2008 presidential campaign. The author of a new book, Beyond Reason, Debunking Conservative Lies, Delusions, and Falsehoods, and What You Really Need to Know Before You Vote, he joins us to discuss how far American politics have moved to the right compared to Europe, with no representative for the political left except for Bernie Sanders, as the center-right and the far-right candidates battle it out for leader of the free world. Then finally, we'll look into whether the government will run out of money on Friday with the continuing resolution stalled in the Senate because Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has excluded funds for Flint, Michigan, while including emergency help for flood victims in Louisiana. As he insists on a rider that would block the Securities and Exchange Commission's new rule to require publicly traded companies to disclose their political spending. Rachel Curley, a Democracy Associate at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss the Republican priority of keeping corporate political spending secret from the voters while holding up $220 million in water infrastructure for Flint, where citizens have been exposed to lead poisoning from drinking the water. And joining us now is Tom Rochhert, who's a founding partner at A&R Strategies LLC, who served as a national security speechwriter for President Clinton. And he's also a co-founder of one of the world's premier speechwriting firms, West Wing Writers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Rochhert.
Thanks very much, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And, you know, I was watching the debate last night, the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And as Trump became more and more unhinged and, you know, rattled and really exposing who he really is, and she was calm and poised. Republicans accuse her of being smug, but nevertheless, I remember the interview I did with you back in July when you had a piece in Politico. And the line that I remember from that piece was, "Nothing is more dangerous than a weak man with power. And Trump is weak, very weak. He can't take the pain of arguments and evidence that contradict his self-image." And that really did seem to be on display last night. I mean, you probably won't disagree with that, right?
Well, there were parts of the debate that unfolded as I both expected and hoped. The problem that Trump has that he cannot dismiss an attack on his image and get back to the mission or the message, because his image is his mission and his message. That got exposed last night in a way that it had not in the Republican debates, because at the beginning, there were 13 people on stage with him. And you don't have that much airtime, first of all. And he gets in trouble the more airtime he has. But also, it was just, you know, it took people a while to see what his weaknesses were. And as soon as they begin to see the thin skin, you cannot miss it. And so she executed her plan very well, which was identify the places that he's most sensitive about, that he's a rich man, that he's a successful businessman, that he has these great assets and properties, And she began to punch at that. And he couldn't get back to his message because he was just consumed with the idea of defending himself.
So at times, though, it seemed like it was down to watching a kind of, you know, 5-year-old schoolboy, you know, in a, having a kind of tantrum. There was a childishness about, for example, his defense of being the king of the Bertha movement. It was just absurd, the way he named other names, like Sidney Blumenthal. I mean, as though it, that's a part of it that I couldn't understand, how anybody could not see the incredible deficiencies in this man. And I kept saying to myself, how did he get this far? And yet, here he is. You know, we don't even know whether the needle's going to be moved by this. I mean, I imagine Hillary's partisans, followers, think it's all over now. But, you know, you never know.
Well, I think the Trump team was not eager to defend him after that. I think that they wanted to get out. It was hard for anyone to say in a convincing way that he did well. But his deficiency really was about the self-image, because when you are in a scene like that and someone takes a shot at you, your job is to take the hit, pivot, and attack. And he wasn't able to take the hit. So he spent the whole time defending himself. That's why he gave such long answers to the Bertha question. That's why he gave this terribly long answer on Iraq. And nobody talked to Sean Hannity. And tracing it all the way back in sort of a mad, grasping way of defending itself. One of my friends said it was like he was tightening the noose around his neck and kicking away the stool at that point. But that's just it. If you cannot take a shot at your self-image, absorb it, turn and attack, or take another message or begin another line of argument, you're buried on defense. And Hillary had to do it when he went to her on emails. And she understood the formula at this point. She said, it was a mistake. I certainly wouldn't do it again. And then she turned and was done with it. At that point, Hillary was just watching him drown.
So is there any possibility then that this will be what will happen in the second and third debates? Do you think it's so deeply ingrained? I mean, what the pundits are saying was, well, he didn't prepare himself. And the assumption being, if he just does a little more prep, he'll do fine.
Well, that he needs almost a personality transplant to do a different job in the second debate. I think Hillary will go in with a lot of justified confidence into the second debate. If you're trying to prepare Donald Trump for the second debate, you have a big challenge. First of all, I would say I saw two moments where Trump, I thought, was at his best. First, he said, you know, I have the National Rifle Association endorsement. I'm proud of it. But people on the no-fly list should not get guns. That was a great moment for him. And then he also said, look, you're not going to shut a plant down here, build a plant in Mexico, and think you're going to sell over here what you built over there without paying a tax. You're not going to do it. That was clear. It was a distinctive policy difference. It was very popular. It made a lot of sense. It was a clear graphic. The problem is he doesn't have enough insightful policy pronouncements like those two to fill 95 minutes when he's on the stage with only one other person. He doesn't have the policy depth to do that. That's one problem that he faces. The next problem that he faces is his own personality. Now, one of the things I said in the piece was, when Trump gets abusive and belligerent, he's sending a signal that he's getting hit where it hurts. So his opponent should just thank him for the guidance and keep hitting him in the same spot. Well, Hillary's got that now. It's like if you take a boxing analogy, and she's got a sharp jab, and she's open to cut over his right eye, and she's just going to keep popping it. And he's going to start bleeding. It's going to look ugly. But I think that's where we are now. I think she has a lot of confidence. He's not a very agile guy. It's going to be very hard for him to change his approach. And maybe impossible for him to let, I'm sure his handlers have got to be working with him, if he's willing to train, to practice taking those shots and deflecting them. them. So, you know, you'd have him in a debate room, and you'd have someone who's playing the role of Hillary, who's saying, you know, you start a business with a $14 million loan from your father. You wanted the housing price to collapse so you could go in and make money. You supported the Iraq War. Everything that he finds hard to take, that he couldn't take, he's got to practice taking it. That's what he's got to try to do. I don't think he could do it, but that's what he's got to try to do.
Well, so far what the Trump camp are saying is that next time he's going to go after her harder, and that presumably means bringing up Bill Clinton's peccadilloes. But in general, what I saw last night was a bit like pulling back the curtain in The Wizard of Oz and finding this frightened man. It was a kind of a slow-motion deflation of all of this bombast and, you know, power talking that his campaign's all about. And once the cliches, he started to run out of them, he really didn't have anything to say. It was an incredible evisceration of a kind of, or the unmasking, if you will, of this massive fraud. So the question then that hits you is, how did he get this far?
Well, I think he got this far in part because of the Republican field. One reason is the Republican field. There were so many, and he was just a bit above all the others. And the way in which they presented their debates, he got, you know, more than everyone else, but still total speaking time of maybe 5 minutes, 6 minutes. He didn't have to answer. Another thing, though, is people didn't really get his weakness. No, he hadn't been in prior debates. He hadn't been in prior political campaigns. People didn't really know how to take him down. One of the things I read that I found very interesting in a biography of George Wallace is that he was determined never to have any close friends because he was terrified that people would find out where his weaknesses are. Trump is so unself-aware that he doesn't even know he has weaknesses, but we've seen enough of him now to know what they are. So that's another piece. People have begun to understand how he's weak and how you can show that he's weak. And at the end of the debate last night, on the split screen, Hillary looked very composed, quite happy, really content, actually. And he looked tired and defeated. His face just creased in a strange way. He puts his mouth in the most varied kind of positions, depending on his emotion. But he really looked like a defeated guy. So those, I think, are reasons why he got as far. And there is a great deal of discontent, and this is just on the political and policy side. It's true, the Democrats have not done a very good job for the working class for years now. Much too aligned with Wall Street in the eyes of people, and we are suffering this exodus of jobs from the Rust Belt, from, you know, manufacturing sector. And so he was able to play on a lot of that.
So what explained the weird sniffling? Chelsea Handler is tweeting that he must be doing cocaine.
You know, he probably has a cold. Those people go through terribly rigorous days and schedules and itineraries. Think of how many hands they're shaking and how many of those people shaking their hands have colds. So he probably had a cold. I'm surprised that Hillary didn't say, be careful with that, Donald. You might get pneumonia.
Well, that was the obvious thing where they talked about stamina. And it was clear that he was just fading. And she was just as fresh as a daisy by the end of it. And she did have a good line about being in front of that ridiculous Republican congressional kangaroo court on Benghazi for, what, 8 hours or whatever it was. But I don't know that any of this stuff moves the needle. This is what scares the hell out of me, is that you can be accomplished, you can be experienced, you can be reasonable, you can be rational. You can have the best arguments, you can have all the facts at hand, and the other person can, you know, just be a kind of out-of-control demagogue shouting slogans, and yet the public are so damn angry that they can't stand status quo politicians, and anybody that's an outsider, no matter how flawed, is going to get their vote.
Well, I don't think we've reached that point yet. I think, and I was hoping, that we pull Donald Trump into an arena where his flaws are exposed, that he is a weak man, and that he cannot take a punch. To be a president, to be a successful presidential candidate, I hope, you have to be able to take a punch and act like you never got hit. You can't be distracted. Imagine to have a president who has to face a national security crisis and is upset because he's personally offended by some statement of out of state. That would be catastrophic. Not to be, or to someone who's got a vendetta, who wants vengeance over something very trite. I mean, Hillary really did her homework, and she said during the debate yesterday that he heard, Donald Trump heard a story of Iranian sailors taunting ours as their vessels passed, and Trump said, if I were president and they taunted our sailors, I'd blow them out of the water. Well, that's absurd, ultimately, and she needs to call him out for that. But we saw last night, I think CNN had 20 Florida undecideds watching, and 18 said they thought Hillary won. So that's reassuring.
Well, on that particular statement that he made, which was that he said if the Iranians and those little speedboats come up too close to our beautiful warships and taunt us, as they've been doing, implying that Obama is a weakling because he does nothing about it, and Hillary is also, because of her ties to Obama, does nothing about it, but he would blow them out of the water. And, of course, he'd blithely unaware that that's an act of war. And, again, we know that all these national security experts have, on the Republican side, in Republican administrations, have written these kind of frantic letters disavowing him. My understanding is a lot of that has to do with what's going on in the intelligence world about revelations about, how much Putin has influence over him, which is yet to be proven. But we do know about financial ties, and we certainly know that there's a active measures, as the KGB used to call it, underway to destabilize our elections, either to tip the scale for Trump or to just sow confusion. The motive being that Putin, having destroyed democracy in Russia, is telling his own people that we may not have a democracy, but they don't really have it in America either. So that's a long-winded way to say that this guy's deeply compromised, it seemed, and I don't know how he got this far. And my only explanation is that our press is useless. They're not doing a job. They've given him equal time. They've given him billions of dollars worth of free media. And they don't go after all of these smoking guns.
Yeah, but I think that I agree if we had a much more informed electorate and a much more aggressive media, it would be harder for Trump. But I think that the people who are for him now would not be persuaded even by more rigorous reporting. I think they needed to see him go up against an opponent and look weak. That's the thing that they love about him, that he was strong, that he could say things that they couldn't get away with and no one could stop him, that he could thumb his nose, that he could ridicule the establishment, and the establishment couldn't do anything against him because he was strong. But last night he didn't appear as strong. So even people who prefer him can't be as excited about him because he was defeated. He was clearly defeated. His face showed defeat. So I am, of course, worried about him and Putin. I think he has a genuine affection for Putin, or admiration for Putin as a strong-armed tyrant. Nobody gives him any grief, that kind of thing. And Putin is probably the world's biggest mischief maker. There's a Lawrence Friedman line in his book on strategy that strategy is really getting more out of a situation than the starting balance of power would suggest. And for that, you've got to do deception, misinformation, trickery of all kinds. And that's Putin's aim, to maintain some kind of power and relevance in the world. There's all kinds of mischief and messing with our elections. Hopefully to deliver him an ally in the White House by the name of Trump has got to be what would be a strategic triumph for Putin.
Well, just in closing, Tom Rochette, The Brexit vote was shocking to a lot of people because they assumed that the United Kingdom is a country with largely educated people who are politically sophisticated and are engaged in the world, and yet they voted in this reactionary and xenophobic way. My sense is that there is probably less education in this country, more division, more racism, more anger, and therefore there may be a bigger constituency for Trump than we think.
Yeah, I think that he has a fair amount of people who support him who are angry and disaffected. But whether they will continue to embrace him enthusiastically when they see him weak, I doubt. Now, we have one advantage over the Brexit vote in that we have the image of one candidate versus another candidate on a stage for 90 minutes under questioning. And I would say Hillary's most presidential moment last night was when she talked about Trump, very loosely saying, questioning the nuclear umbrella, questioning whether we should keep the nuclear protection of allies such as South Korea and Japan, or whether they should go ahead and get nuclear weapons. And Hillary said, I want to reassure our allies, and then proceeded along those lines. Contrast that with something that came very soon after, when Hillary said that Donald had called women pigs, slobs, dogs. And he said, I never said that. I didn't say that. Where did you find this? And three times he said, where did you find this? He was acting like a child.
Right.
Compared to someone who was acting presidential. We have the benefit now, since we saw it last night, and I didn't know what was going to unfold. I'm very relieved at what happened. But there we saw personified one set of views and another set of views. And the person who is embodying the set of views that we deplore, to use a word that's been used recently, failed to look good, looked weak, looked worse by far. So I find that all very reassuring.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Tom Rossett.
Thank you very much, Ian. Enjoyed it.
And again, I've been speaking with Tom Rossett, who's a founding partner at ANR Strategies LLC, who served as the national security speechwriter for President Clinton and was co-founder of one of the world's premier speechwriting firms, West Wing Writers. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the impact of the 7.6 million overseas voters in this election that are vulnerable to hacking.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us in the studio is John Paul Bernbach, who during the 2008 presidential campaign was spokesperson for Democrats Abroad and the Democratic Party in Europe. He served as a board member of the Democratic Leadership for the 21st Century, where he served as co-chair for foreign affairs. His latest book just out is Beyond Reason, Debunking Conservative Lies, Delusions and Falsehoods, and What You Really Need to Know Before You Vote. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Paul Bernbach.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And I've been covering the recent warning by the minority chairs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees about the extent to which Russia and Putin are interfering in the U.S. elections. And I had on the program yesterday an expert on voting machines and voting systems in the United States. And if Putin wanted to hack the results and change them in Trump's favor, he has a pretty narrow window. Basically, you know, more than half of Pennsylvania have vulnerable machines, some of Virginia and Georgia. but most of the other vulnerable machines are in non-swing states. So that's not the issue, but it is an issue when it comes to the votes for Democrats abroad, because they do have to pass electronically over the internet, and they are therefore vulnerable. So what are the numbers we're talking about here?
It's been a while, actually, since I saw updated numbers, but I know that a number of years ago there were somewhere on the order of 6 million U.S. citizens living abroad, and the majority of those are Democrats, I think about two-thirds of, so that's roughly about 4 million living abroad.
That's a few votes.
That's an important distinction. The reason I make a distinction between Democrats and citizens in general is because the Republican Party doesn't have an active counterpart to Democrats abroad, which is actually a part of the Democratic Party. It's an official part of the Democratic Party. There is a global primary, so expats who are Democrats don't need to vote absentee from their home states in the United States. They can actually participate in a global primary. And then in 08, I'm not sure about 2012, but in 08, the Democrats abroad sent 22 delegates to the National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. So it's an active part of the Democratic Party. It's almost like a virtual 51st state. So those concerns about Russian hacking or anybody else hacking the expat vote would apply only to Democratic votes.
So what was your sense then of the debate last night? I mentioned before the debate started that a lot of people I've spoken to were even too afraid to watch the vote. They were so anxious because there's such an investment on the part of Democrats in Hillary Clinton doing well. And did you feel that she did well?
I did, and I was pleasantly surprised. I have to say, I had a feeling that Trump would do quite well, not so much in an objective sense, but in relation to the expectations that people had of him. I, like a lot of Democrats, was alarmed by the this National Security Forum of a couple of weeks ago that was hosted by Matt Lauer, where Trump sort of walked all over Lauer, and I think that he presented himself in that forum as a relatively credible person, and certainly temperamentally he was very calm. And what I was worried about was that he would bring that same performance to bear in the debate last night. And simply by seeming not to be crazy and not to be a buffoon and not basically not being Mussolini, that he would exceed expectations and calm the nerves of a lot of wavering Republicans who've heard a lot about him but haven't yet fully engaged with the election. That was what I thought was going to happen. I was wrong, and I was very happy to be proved wrong. I thought Clinton was very sharp. She was on point, obviously had a command of the issues, but I think more importantly than actually having a command of the issues is expressing them in a way that seems reasonable and informed, but not overly in the weeds. And she did a very good job of that, whereas Trump was all over the place, and I think he lost control of himself after about half an hour. And I think that's very difficult for it. I think it's very difficult to spin, and you could sort of see that a lot of conservatives and pro-Trump people were having a lot of trouble coming up with a reasonable way of excusing his bad performance.
But then the question looms, why isn't Hillary Clinton 20 points ahead?
Excellent question, and it's a vexing one. I would say that based on the debate, she may well get a bit of a bump. There is an enormous proportion of the electorate, which is up until quite recently, up until the most recent polls that I've seen, undecided for this late in the season. I think it's about 20%. That's remarkably high, and I think it reflects a disenchantment that so many Americans have with the process and with both parties and with these two particular candidates. However, I think that as we get closer to the election, people start to realize, to weigh their decisions more carefully and realize that their vote is going to have an impact and that it's going to have serious consequences for all of us. I think that what happened last night demonstrates that you have one candidate who, however much you may disagree with her or dislike her, disagree with her policies, or maybe not even like her personally, is a competent set of hands, and another candidate who I think demonstrated pretty decisively that he doesn't really know what he's talking about and doesn't really have the temperament to be president. Now, so I suspect that the undecided vote will narrow. And I suspect that Clinton will get a bit more of those than Trump will. But this has been a very surprising year, and I don't think that any of us can really predict things with great confidence. I think we can just kind of play the odds.
So then the next question, John Paul, is how did Trump get this far?
Well, you know, having said that he didn't perform very well in the debate last night, I think he performed well in the debates during the Republican primary, and that's a big part of it. He was, I think, when he was on a stage with a dozen or more opponents, his particular kind of bluster and self-confidence was more effective. It certainly effectively discomfited a lot of his opponents, so he looked like a stronger person. And of course, those qualities are much more important to Republicans or to a certain faction of Republican voters than to Democrats. Like looking strong, seeming decisive, seeming like the toughest guy in the room is an asset that I think served him very well. I think also he is, you know, thinking about it more from an ideological and policy standpoint, I don't think that Donald Trump came out of nowhere. I think he's the logical conclusion of roughly 30 years of conservative rhetoric and conservative ideology. One of the things that's been noted by a number of commentators, including myself, is that Trump has really the main thing that Trump, I think, has done is he's made explicit many things that were implicit on the Republican side for many decades. So whereas Republicans didn't come out and say things that were overtly bigoted or as aggressive and bellicose as what Trump says, they've been implying it, and they've been using dog whistles and code words and signals and things like that about us and them, about immigration, about Muslims, about African Americans, and Trump has just come out and said these things overtly, and I think he put a lot of his opponents in a very, 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 very painful position because by basically blowing the ruse and coming out and saying things bluntly, they were in the position of not being able to affirm what he said, but at the same time not being able to deny what he said for fear of alienating that part of their base that actually supports those sorts of views and attitudes.
But when you say 30 years of Republican dog whistles has led to this point, that's a point well taken. But also Donald Trump turned the tables on Hillary Clinton last night when he was effective early in the debate by saying, you know, you've been at this for 30 years and we have 30 years worth of, well, at the moment we have dysfunctional government, gridlock, and all of these disasters, frankly, most of which were caused by George W. Bush. But nevertheless, the case is made. And basically, I think it's a hard case to defend. We are in the year of the outsider, and status quo politicians are roadkill.
That's a nice way of putting it, and I agree with it. I agree with that point, and I think that has a lot to do with Hillary Clinton's unpopularity. I don't think it's entirely a personal thing. I do think there's a lot of sexism, and I think there's a lot of personal dislike of her, but I also think the fact is that she is as establishment a figure as there is in American politics today. And I say that in a neutral way. You know, the fact is that she has been at the center of American power and influence, both politically and even culturally, for decades, quite literally. And there is a very, very sour mood in the country against the status quo. And that's true on the right and on the left. In the case of the Democratic primary, I think that explains a lot of why Bernie Sanders was such a surprising success and gave Hillary Clinton a very, very serious run for her money. And she just managed to pull that out. On the right, the anti-establishment candidate prevailed. And I think that makes some sense for a lot of reasons, especially because the Republican Party has been an anti-government party, at least rhetorically speaking. I mean, I make the point in my book that the Republican Party actually, you know, tends to grow the size of government and increase the debt and the deficits much more than Democrats do when they're in power. But nevertheless, their rhetoric is relentlessly anti-government. And so it makes sense that an anti-establishment, anti-government figure and an outsider would naturally have an advantage, especially in a year like today, like this one. In the case of Hillary Clinton, I think she's also an establishment person, and she suffered very much as a result of that. And that is a huge challenge for her to overcome.
But I think your point that you just made, that the Republicans are also a big government party, although the rhetoric says the opposite, I think it gets down to a difference about the purpose of government. On the Democratic side, there's still some vestiges of the idea of social democracy, which, of course, you have in Europe. And the average American, if they really knew about what the average German or Swede or Norwegian have, in terms of rights as citizens, mm-hmm. full health coverage, pregnancy leave, 6 weeks vacation, union representatives on boards of directors, all of these things that we don't even know about over here because we even think that next door in Canada, they're all, you know, dying in the streets because they have free health care. So we do have that. But unfortunately, you know, the party is also has pivoted towards Wall Street. So you have a bit of a conflict within the Democratic Party itself about the direction. And that's what Bernie Sanders brought to the table, making it a clear case to move the party to the left. On the Republican side, they grow government because they see government as a piggy bank for their cronies. I mean, the purpose of government with payday lenders and for-profit colleges and all of these scams that are going on now with this privatization mania is basically to divert taxpayer money into the pockets of capitalist cronies living off socialist fat of the land.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely true. I think that that another thing that accounts for Republicans growing the debt and the deficits is because they want to pursue these policies without actually cutting services, which would make them unpopular. You know, I think there's a famous line of Dick Cheney, who said is reported to have said in a cabinet meeting, or maybe not even a cabinet meeting, just a meeting in the Oval Office, to the then Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, "Reagan proved that deficits don't matter." I actually quote that line in one of the chapters of my book. And I'm convinced that he wasn't making an economic statement. He was making a political statement. His point being that being responsible for large deficits and increasing the national debt doesn't matter politically. You don't pay a price for it if you actually do it. One of the great jujitsu moves that the GOP has done is that by labeling the Democrats tax and spend liberals and creating very effectively an idea in the public mind that the Democratic Party is fiscally irresponsible and that the GOP is the serious party when it comes to budgets and keeping our fiscal house in order. They're the only party that talks about balanced budgets. They're the only party that talks about the debt and the deficit. You very rarely hear Democrats talk about these things.
Yeah, but you heard Donald Trump talk about it endlessly last night.
Yes, he did. And that was a very smart thing for him to do because he's tapping into economic anxiety and frustration that is a nonpartisan issue when it comes to working people in this country.
But it's a complete delusion, because the United States can't go broke, and it's completely irrelevant.
Well, also our debt and deficits are at manageable levels. The fact is that if you could look at them compared to historical levels, they are, you know, the national debt is pretty high. But it's certainly not as high as it was during World War II, and we successfully paid that down, and it hasn't crippled the economy.
And it's certainly not stopping everybody in the world from sending their money to the United States.
Absolutely.
So we know it's nonsense.
But may I just say something? Because I think this brings up a very, very important point, which makes a very important distinction between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and this is really the crux of what my book is and why I wrote the book. They understand, I think, in a way that Democrats don't, that most people are not well informed about these issues. They don't understand the dynamics of government and economic policy. They don't really know what the history is, and which means that they are vulnerable to being manipulated. And they're also going to respond to the narrative or the account that is most persuasive in and of itself or that taps into their own fears or their own hopes. Whereas Democrats, I think, don't tend to calculate their message in the same sort of way. And I think that Republicans understand if they talk a lot about debt and deficits, they'll get credit for being fiscally responsible regardless of what they do. Mm-hmm. And I think their record and their success at the ballot box relative to Democrats on these issues has demonstrated that fact.
So we've established the difference between the parties in terms of government. The Republicans are into right-wing welfare, which is the military-industrial complex, agribusiness, subsidies for oil companies, et cetera, and these bottom-feeding.
And low tax rates on.
Yeah, low tax rates for the
particularly
rich,
the investor class.
And the investor class and the inheritor class.
Yeah.
And supporting all these bottom feeders like the payday lenders and for-profit colleges, which, by the way, a lot of Democrats support as well because Washington's all about buying politicians.
Money.
So that we've established that. But in terms of your new book, Beyond Reason, Debunking Conservative Lies, Delusions, and Falsehoods, and what you really need to know before you vote, I've spoken to George Lakoff a number of times about his way he talks about the deficit framing on the left and that the Republicans are much better at framing things like tax relief. If you're not in favor of tax relief, you're therefore in favor of tax pain.
Right.
So they're very clever at that. But I noticed after the debates last night, they did a town hall in Ohio with a group of voters that were carefully chosen for Democrat-Republican affiliations, and the needle wasn't moved one bit, even though I think any reasonable person watching that display of this out-of-control guy that was so out of his depth, sort of just all over the place, not making any sense, and this very calm, measured woman who really did know what she was talking about. It was just beyond belief, the difference. But it wasn't moving the needle. And one of the people that was interviewed was a Democrat who was going to vote for Trump. And she said, he may be a jackass, but he's a jackass leading that mule train, and I'm going to jump aboard it. So what is going on here? You can have the best arguments in the world. You can be rational and reasonable and present tons of evidence, as Hillary Clinton did last night, and still not win. So what explains that?
I think a number of things. It's a complicated issue, and I would say it's actually not an issue. It's a problem for our republic, our democracy. But I think that, first of all, as we were saying, there's the issue of demeanor and identification. I think a lot of people identify with Trump's attitude. They feel left out. They feel forgotten. They feel overlooked. They feel disrespected by elites and by the establishment. And Donald Trump taps into those anxieties or frustrations or that anger. And he is a standard bearer for those people. And I think that it's understandable. And I think their anger and their frustration are understandable. I think that that both parties, in a sense, have disregarded them to some degree. I mean, you've mentioned a couple times that the Democratic Party is also very attuned to the needs of Wall Street. And I think that what has happened over the last 30 years or so is that both parties have moved quite to the right. You know, we don't really have a left in the United States. Bernie Sanders represents a glimmer of resurgence there. But my view of American politics in general is that the Democratic Party is a centrist party. The Republican Party is a right-wing party. And we don't have a left-wing party in this country. Right. But we have the habit of thinking of the Democratic Party as the party of the left. And so we have the habit of thinking of the center or moderation, political moderation, as being somewhere between the center and the center and the right. And so somebody like Hillary Clinton and to a lesser extent Barack Obama are figures who would fit in any other advanced democracy in the world would fit very, very comfortably on the center right. You know, if you look at the policies of the Obama administration, for instance, he, during his presidency, has lined up very comfortably with David Cameron in the UK, with Angela Merkel in Germany, with Sarkozy in France before he left office. That's where the Democratic Party lines up. And the GOP doesn't really line up with anybody, but insofar as they do, depending on the issue, they tend to line up with the far, far right.
Right. But I've always felt that anybody who had my political views was unelectable. I have no illusions that this is not a right-wing country. It is a very right-wing country. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons why the left is so weak in this country is that it really hasn't presented a very cogent argument.
Yes.
And the Green Party's arguments are just ridiculous.
Yes.
Bernie Sanders was the first time I ever heard anything that made any sense.
Yes.
And when, you know, regular people hear that message, even on the right, you know, people support Trump also like Bernie.
Yes.
I mean, this is the beginning of something and it needs to be nurtured. But just in closing, how do you explain how this guy, Donald Trump, could be this populist leader with all of these, for the right reasons, for this standard bearer, for all of this anger that's going out there, all of which is completely justified, yet he represents the people who've screwed America. And he's one of the 1% or the 1% of the 1%. And his entire history is about himself, about screwing everybody else and taking care of himself and his family. How could they have chosen this guy?
Again, it's a mystery for the ages, I would say, Ian. But if I had to hazard a guess, I would say a lot of it has to do with the fact that he speaks in terms that they understand. He seems like a strong man. He is contemptuous of authority and it's the establishment, and that reflects the mood of the people. And people are very good at rationalizing the things that maybe don't fit in with their views or that they are less appealing. But I think that what really the support that Trump has is, I think there are two major reasons. One is sheer partisanship. We live in a very polarized partisan times, and there are some people who are going to vote for the Republican no matter what. And then there are other people who sincerely do feel that Trump speaks for them, and I think they're identifying with his with the fact that he's going to go to Washington and blow things up. I think that the people are so hostile to government, they feel so neglected and betrayed to some degree by government, that they relish the idea of seeing somebody who may just blow the whole thing up. And they don't really care because the status quo is bad enough that they're willing to go with the devil they don't know.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio, John Paul Birnbach.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, during 2008 campaign, John Paul Birnbach was spokesman for Democrats Abroad and the Democratic Party in Europe. He was a board member of the Democratic Leadership for the 21st Century, where he served as co-chair for foreign affairs. And his latest book just out is Beyond Reason, Debunking Conservative Lies, Delusions and Falsehoods, and What You Really Need to Know Before You Vote. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the government will run out of money on Friday because Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is insisting on keeping corporate political spending secret from the voters.
You don't need to change your futures are. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rachel Curley, who is a Democracy Associate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Curley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
But the country, I don't think, should be happy about what's happening in Washington, and that is the continuing resolution to fund the government is stalled because the Senate voted 45 to 55 on a GOP resolution that would fund the government through December the 9th, but not provide financial aid for Flint, Michigan, but while providing emergency help for flood victims in Louisiana, Maryland, and West Virginia. And my understanding, and this, what this is all about, is that Mitch McConnell is basically putting in a rider that would block not just denying the citizens of Flint, Michigan, long-needed federal aid, but his main focus is to keep corporate political spending hidden from the voters. And the rider that he's put in there would block the Securities and Exchange Commission from working on a rule to require publicly traded companies to disclose their political spending. And that seems to be the main sticking point in the way of this deal. So do you think at some point or other the American people are going to figure out that these are the priorities of Mitch McConnell?
Absolutely. And what you've described is exactly what's happening. McConnell has put forth a continuing resolution that does include this inappropriate policy rider regarding the SEC. And I think the question definitely is, why is it so important to him to continue to protect secret corporate political spending at the expense of a potential government shutdown on Friday? And the rule that we're talking about is one that is in front of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it has been called for a number of years and by a broad coalition of people. Particularly, 1.2 million Americans have commented on this particular rulemaking, asking the SEC to move forward with requiring public companies to disclose where they spend money in politics. And the SEC has been prevented from moving forward on this rulemaking because of the rider in the federal budget. And it's an inappropriate place to have this discussion about corporate political spending. And so the question definitely is, to Leader McConnell, why is this so important and why is it holding up the movement on the CR?
And on the other issue, which is not giving money to Flint, but giving money to Louisiana, which is clearly partisan, Louisiana being Republican and Michigan being Democrat, and particularly Flint itself, We're only talking about $220 million to address the water infrastructure necessary in Flint, where children have been poisoned and, in fact, you know, affected for life by lead poisoning. So that, again, is pretty shameful.
Absolutely. And the line that congressional Republicans have given as sort of an excuse for not addressing Flint directly is that there is a separate bill that addresses it. And Senator Barbara Boxer was actually just on the House, or excuse me, on the Senate floor this afternoon saying that she does not think that it is fair to risk what is going to happen to that bill in the House because it still has to be negotiated on the House side. And therefore, there is a risk there that the bill would not move forward and would not provide aid to Flint. And so therefore, now in the CR is the time to provide that, like you said, much-needed aid for Flint. And if aid is going to Louisiana, why can it not also go to Flint at the same time? And the proposal for Flint would already be paid for. And so I think that she's very right in bringing up that concern and asking that question as well.
But earlier I had read reports, Rachel, that they were also putting in riders, these poison pill riders, on, for example, extending the hours that truckers can drive these big rigs without rest. And we all know from what happened to the comedian Tracy Morgan, where he was almost killed by an out-of-control 18-wheeler whose driver had fallen asleep because of working long hours for Walmart. Where does that rider stand? Is that still in there?
I'm actually, I haven't been following that rider closely, so I'm not actually sure where that particular one stands. Mm. But I know that there is a broad coalition who are calling for, you know, no ideological policy riders, particularly because riders like that one and like the SEC political spending one should not be part of the overall funding discussion. They should be debated on their own in sort of the typical fashion as regular legislation. And congressional Republicans have been trying to insert these riders into the federal budget process as a way of forcing them to be approved because we have to approve the budget. And so that is why sort of a broad swath of organizations with all kinds of priorities have been calling for a clean budget and to remove these kinds of riders because it's not the place to be discussing these particular positions and particular issues and types of legislation.
So is that where the 45 to 55 vote comes down on? Is it about riders in general? Because my understanding is that at the end of the day, McConnell is going to need Democratic votes to get the continuing resolution approved. And you've only got, what, two more days before the government runs out of money. I noticed that Senators Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Bill Nelson of Florida, and John Tester of Montana were the only Democrats to support the continuing resolution vote. But 13 Republicans also voted against McConnell's backed proposal.
Yeah, I think congressional Democrats are really holding firm on this issue. They have been calling for years for these particular riders to be removed, and I think with they're just holding firm on their position and, again, trying to ask McConnell and bring the American people's attention to his original proposal, which, again, did not include aid for Flint and included this policy rider on the SEC political spending disclosure rule, and asking him why those are so important to him and why they have to be a sticking point in these particular negotiations. And I will also just say that sort of debating riders during the CR process is very highly unusual because the CR, and that refers to continuing resolution, is supposed to just continue status quo funding, again, to keep the government from shutting down. And so the fact that he is sort of being a stick in the mud about the Flint funding and about this particular ideological rider is highly unusual at this point. And so congressional Democrats are sticking to it and really holding him on these issues. I think they will continue to do so through the negotiations.
So if the demand is to have a clean bill, as they call it, continuing resolution, who really has the leverage here? It seems like given the number of Republicans that voted against McConnell's bill, and you've only got two more days before the government runs out of money, and the Democrats are holding firm, as you say, does that mean that all of these riders are taken off the bill before a vote will pass? That seems like the logical thing to do.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I can't speak to exactly what is going to happen, but I do know that, like I said, the Democrats are really holding firm. And it is not, it's a very valid question to ask Leader McConnell why he's so committed to protecting secret corporate political spending, especially when Americans have been paying a lot of attention to correcting the course of our democracy, particularly in this election year. And polling shows that Americans in great numbers would like to see a more balanced democracy, one that is not beholden to special interests and beholden to big business. And so with the population so interested in a more functioning democracy, the question becomes, why is he committed to keeping this rider in and to protecting secret political spending at this point? And I think that is a very strong argument, and definitely it's holding him accountable in this moment.
Well, but just in closing, we know the reason. If the Securities and Exchange Commission was able to get through this rule to require publicly traded companies to disclose their political spending, that will prevent a lot of these big corporations whose CEOs are partisan Republicans from secretly giving money to the Republicans, because if they have to do it openly, their customers, half of whom are Democrats, are going to object. So this is, I think, really it's smoking out this dishonest way to spend public or publicly traded companies' monies, because the leadership of these companies happen to be partisan.
Absolutely. And I will say one thing that we sort of like to highlight is how important transparency and disclosure of political spending is to the shareholders of these corporations that are spending secretly. And many of those 1.2 million comments that came into the SEC on this particular rulemaking are from investors and from institutional investors and from pension funds and from, you know, like I said, the shareholders who own the wealth of these corporations and want to know whether or not the management is spending their money in a risky way on politics. And so the transparency is deeply important to all Americans who are looking to, again, sort of correct the balance of our democracy, but also to shareholders in these particular companies who would like, you know, as much information as possible about where their money is being spent in politics.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Rachel Curley.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rachel Curley, who's a Democracy Associate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.